Okay, we're going to both make brief statements and then open for questions. So if I could begin, New Zealand's growth rate in recent years has been poor. The perception has been that this economy was growing strongly, yet long before the recent recession, we were in decline. We've had 5 years of export decline, recession in those receipts, we've had that falling back in exports at a time when the government has been considerably accelerating its own expenditure. We don't think we can continue to accelerate consumption based on more government spending while incomes stagnate and in some cases fall. The challenge is pretty simple. It's to produce more goods and services the rest of the world actually wants. And the only way we can create more and worthwhile jobs is following that prescription. The government is in a powerless financial position, and some departments this year, or in fact for a number of years, will receive no additional funding, not because they don't deliver good and worthwhile services, but simply because we don't want to see the government going into greater debt than is currently the case. The human cost of a legacy like that is considerable. People lose jobs, others leave the country, and families continue to struggle. So we think we have a clear choice. We can continue to muddle along, handicapped by those imbalances and falling further behind countries that we'd like to consider ourselves similar to, or we can set our sights higher and create a country where people have the opportunity to live more fulfilling lives. The mining issue has been seen through the, should be seen, I should say, the mining issue should be seen through the lens of any sector analysis in the New Zealand economy. Albeit one that does have a heightened environmental consideration or element to it. Developing a tiny proportion of New Zealand's mineral potential would make a significant difference to New Zealand's economic development. The government's proposals to remove areas from Schedule 4 are limited to pinpoint areas on which it has good initial information on significant mineralisation in those areas. Contrary to the rhetoric of those who oppose any mining, what is proposed is neither short-term thinking nor is it old economy. We have mineral wealth in this country for which there is significant global demand, and not just for the short term. These minerals contribute the building blocks of modern societies, and demand for them is likely to be substantial for hundreds of years to come. New Zealand is rich in minerals needed by the IT and energy sectors, for technologies like hybrid and electric cars and other vehicles, wind turbines, computer drives, fibre optic cables, and low energy light bulbs for that matter. We've done a provisional stocktake based on presently known information. Now we want to open up a tiny percentage of Schedule 4 to do more work in finding out what's there and looking at just what might be worthwhile mining in those particular areas. We think it's our duty as a responsible government to tell New Zealanders what they've got and where it is, but they do need to know where it is, how accessible it is, and what balances need to be put in place against the benefits of that activity. The government is only proposing to remove 7,058 hectares of land from Schedule 4, which equates to 0.018% of current Schedule 4 land, or 0.024% of New Zealand's total land area. It impacts on only one national park. The areas that we're talking about are the wider Coromandel and Paparoa National Parks, and this is, of course, to be subject to the public consultation process. The stocktake has identified large areas of Schedule 4, which could be highly prospective. However, the government is not considering removing large areas from the schedule. Instead, we're investing in gathering more information on the mineral potential of these and other non-Schedule 4 prospective areas. To put the issue into perspective, what we are proposing today is opening a chunk of New Zealand to mining that is equivalent to a postcard on the entire size of Eden Park. Minister of Conservation.
Thank you, Jerry. From a conservation point of view, can I say that the government is committed to protecting public conservation land. Conservation is a major contributor to the economy in its own right, as well as providing New Zealand with a unique identity. We will not allow anyone to do anything to compromise our commitment to maintaining a balance between building a viable and prosperous nation and the responsible protection of their environment. The government's objectives are not at the expense of our beautiful natural environment. It is in itself an asset New Zealand must protect. Removal from Schedule 4 does not change an area's classification as public conservation land, nor protections that may be applied as part of land access or resource consent arrangements. It is possible to mine responsibly, and there are examples of this already happening on conservation land. There are also a number of areas totalling 12,400 hectares being considered for addition to Schedule 4, and feedback in the discussion paper on these areas is also sought.
Questions?
There were some environmental concerns, issues of safety concerns raised about potential mining attempts. Have you got any comment about whether you're going to do anything to
Well, firstly, there is an area proposed for removal from Schedule 4 around Thames, and there is sitting alongside that a GNS report that says that the geology around Thames is significantly disturbed, and that large unexpected weather patterns could create quite a havoc. That situation exists right now before there's any mining. If there was an application for mining there, quite clearly the RMA process, which still prevails throughout all of this, is going to require the sort of mitigation that perhaps is not there at the present time to ensure that we don't get those sort of catastrophic situations developing. I think you need to put it in the perspective of the difficulty that might exist there exists right now, today, and has done for a long time. If there is some mining activity in there, clearly some of that may be mitigated against.
You've talked about, this paper's talking about $18 billion potentially in the Coromandel. How much do you generally think that you might be able to get out of this in the years to come?
Yeah, I think those numbers are indicative of the sort of resource that might be there. The reality is, until there is an activity going on, you just don't know what that flow of cash might be. But that's a number that is big enough, and it's an in-situ value, so it's before it's ever extracted, that gives you the sort of encouragement you might need to go and do the investigation that may lead to mining.
You've talked about other areas as well here that you'd like further investigation on in South Island, up north and so forth. How keen are you to extend this? When you talk about this being pinpoint,
yep.
Initially when you first talked about Schedule 4 middle of last year, were you hoping that some of these areas might be included today, or wider areas you'd like to see mined?
No, I think right from the start we always said that we wanted to have a look at the potential, that the idea of just saying no, absolutely no consideration is going to take place seemed to me to close things off a little bit. And remember that this whole process started against the background of a very, very considerable inclusion in Schedule 8 in 2008. In the documents you've got there, it goes through looking at what the mineral potential is of every national park and other pieces of the Schedule 4 estate, and concludes in most cases that there's no need to take a further interest. The government has, for its own reasons, decided that Kahurangi and Mount Aspiring are no-go areas. And I think if you think about why they were put into national park in the first place, you get the answer about that. But there are some other places where we think we should be looking and conducting proper aerial magnetic survey to see what the potential is.
So you'd like to go further then?
Oh, I think what you've got in front of you today is the definitive position on the national parks as they are presented. We have said that Rakiura, which is a national park, is an area where we want to have more of a look. And if the exploration that we conduct, the geophysical, geomagnetic survey shows up some interest, then clearly we'll have to talk to all of the parties that are interested in that particular park.
The areas that you're adding to Schedule 4 land, is there any mining mineral
value? We don't know. I could say pretty much no, apart from some of the offshore areas, because a fair chunk of that is marine space. Some of it, if I look just for a minute, particularly on the northern Taranaki coast there, that is iron sand territory. But if you see how small they are compared to the entire coastline.
So why would you add it to Schedule 4, which protects against mining if there's nothing there? Because no-one would bottom line it anyway, doesn't it?
No, I'm saying that there is value there, but they are so small that we think the ecological value of that particular marine space is such that you should set it aside.
Were those areas already earmarked for addition to Sheffield Port?
No, they weren't. There was no proposals for Schedule 4 additions. There's been a lot of land, like these little small spots, where if they were to have been added, they probably would have gone in the very large accumulation that was put into Schedule 4 in 2008. But we've looked at those and think, particularly the two islands off Great Barrier, it makes sense to give them that protection. We've had a long commitment as a political party to marine reserves, and so it's not surprising that we look to create more of those.
Why did you include Uncarnarangi and Mount Aspiri in those areas, and what's so special compared to other national parks?
Well, I think the if you look at particularly Kahurangi, it is very pristine in its condition, and there has to be some parts of the conservation estate that receive that degree of protection. It's like Fiordland. And if you take out those areas from the headline numbers, you're still left with some 60-odd billion potential in the entire area that we're talking about, and maybe more if the aerial magnetic stuff shows it up. It takes time also for the investments that you require to be made. And we felt at this stage it's just, in fact, why would you rescind a decision to protect those areas in that way?
You talked about the other areas that we've been investigating, the public conservation lands on the Coromandel Peninsula. Whereabouts?
Well, if you look at the Coromandel Peninsula, all of that green land at the moment is in Schedule 4.
So most of the Coromandel will be investigated?
Well, that's what we're saying. We want to know more about what is in there. What we know at the moment is those small pink areas have shown up in previous aerial magnetic survey to have high mineral value. Now, I guess part of it will be tempered by the interest that is shown in taking any of those opportunities further. The similar case with Rakiura in the south. And in the south, we're looking particularly at those rare earth elements that are of growing value. The only other country in the world that has significant deposits of those, we're told, is China. And they have a sinking lid through a tariff system on the export of those elements. So that you would expect that to be a growing market opportunity in the years to come.
Hey, Wilkinson, can you honestly say that what's being announced today is not going to detract at all from the value of the conservation estate that you
I'm very comfortable with the discussion paper going, and each case will be on a case-by-case analysis, and I believe there's opportunity there that we can balance the environmental responsibilities with the economic opportunities. And we've just got to be sensible about it and rational about it.
Can you give us an example of a red line test that you mentioned these strict environmental tests here? What's an example of something which would mean that mining would not be allowed to proceed?
Well, I think if you look at some of the areas that have been put in to the schedule, like Burwood Park, for example, well, that's where they've got the Takahi breeding program. Now, something like that is iconic, and it's pretty special. But obviously, that's been put into the schedule. If every case will be looked at individually.
Is this proposal less ambitious than what you originally proposed or hoped for?
No, this has been a long and considered process, as people know. It's sort of, I've got to concede, somewhat irritating that there were leaks along the way. People won't take people long to work out that there was a huge amount of accuracy in those leaks. We're quite prepared to say, or I am prepared to say, that initially when we said to the group that looked at it, so a group of DOC and MED officials, go and tell us where all the minerals are and where are the parts of the country that, the Schedule 4 that's got all the minerals in it. What they came back with was 450,000 hectares. And we said, well, hang on, that's not a goer. That's 400 and something square miles. We currently mine about 40 square kilometres. We currently mine about 10% of that and a figure back from that for actual disturbance on the ground. So we said, look, go and see what you can tell us about more specific mineral deposits inside the schedule. And I think that's when things started to get very, very big discussion, quite specific, and we got to where we are today. And we're very comfortable with that. You can see all that in the document that we provided, the Stocktake document itself. You can see where those large tracts of land are.
How long would it be, I know this is a difficult question to answer, but how long would it be potentially before any of this new wealth is actually taken out of the ground? Are we talking 5 years?
I think 5 years is a reasonable period of time to look at. There's no silver bullet here, but the exploration industry itself spends a lot of money in the process of getting to a mining point. And that has positive economic impact. It also means that you look at things like the nation's self-security or net security position around some of those, particularly those minerals that are going to become in greater demand in the years ahead.
Will they do this if Labor is saying, look, we put it back, I mean, longer term? I mean, if it's going to take that long,
oh, 5 years, they'll be fine, guy, inside the electoral cycle. Yeah, very confident they'll be fine.
But if you were looking at this prospect, you'd have to wonder about political viability.
Well, remember that you're always going to get a certain amount of chest beating and trumpeting around the place on this stuff. But there were 82 mines operating on the Dock Estate under the 9 years of a Labor government. And Pike River gained its consents during that time, not only on the conservation estate but also under a national park. So I don't think that that's... I think the sovereign risk in New Zealand for mining companies is pretty low, and that's what makes us an attractive investment destination.
If mining went ahead on those proposed areas, have officials said to you and mining companies said to you what the creation of jobs would be, what sort of numbers you've been looking for?
Well, we haven't looked specifically at that, I've got to say, but we know that the industry itself, at the current size, employs directly about 8,000 people. If you take the multipliers on that, you're talking about a large number of jobs. This is a 25% increase in available land. 25%, if you take the current 40 square kilometres that we mine, this is making available another 71 square kilometres that as of yesterday weren't available.
If we get 40 to the square now, yeah, and yeah. Get to another 71 on top of 40.
Now, can I explain this carefully? Of all the land that is licensed for prospecting right now, mining activity takes place on about 40 square kilometres. What we've got in front of us is a proposal to open up another 71 square kilometres, and not all of that would be taken up in mining, but you'd expect that, clearly because we've identified it's highly prospective, there's a big opportunity there.
So what weight are you going to give the public submission?
Oh, very high, because we know that areas like Great Barrier, for example, are going to be challenging for people. So we're very, very interested to see exactly what the public response is.
So how would you view it in terms of making a final decision? If you had an overwhelming number of submissions against, would that be enough for you to sway your view to not go ahead? What's the...
Well, politically, you're always moved by public opinion.
So you're tripling the amount of scheduled
small
land available for mining from
40
to
100. No, sorry.
Or 71
total. No. At the moment, there's no mining on Schedule 1 land. None at all. Schedule 4. No mining on Schedule 4 land, but on conservation land, there are 82 mines. Across all land, private land, and conservation land in New Zealand, 40 square kilometres is taken up with mining activity. What I'm saying is that if at the end of the public consultation process all this land becomes available, it's another 71 square kilometres, but the actual space on that 71 that would be taken up would be very, very low. We think probably something in the vicinity of 500 to 1,000 hectares. Yeah.
Does the fact that the mining industry is primarily foreign-owned pose any problems in selling the idea to the public?
I think there's a lot of myth about that. Let me put it in perspective for you. You've got Solid Energy, which is one of the biggest miners in the country, owned by the state. You've got L&M Mining, which is New Zealand owned. You've got any number of other mining companies that are New Zealand owned. Yes, there are foreign owned companies here, and perhaps there'll be a few more of them. But they do spend money, large amounts of money, inside the New Zealand economy. The value of their exports have a net positive effect on the New Zealand economy.
All this emphasis has gone on conservation land. What about other land that's not sensitive or land that's privately owned?
Privately owned land, access to privately owned land is by negotiation with landowners. One of the most important aspects of the release today is the announcement that DOC would expect in the next 2 months to release standard operating procedures from one end of New Zealand to the other. That's very, very significant, because there are quite large amounts of conservation land, not high value, but conservation land where we've currently got mining activity that could benefit from, that would become more available for mining if we had consistent protocols across the country for access.
Why are we looking at the sensitive part of conservation land? Have we exhausted the possibility of other land, and that includes private land?
Well, it's been a long known fact that a significant proportion of the mineral potential in New Zealand resides in the conservation state.
What are those minerals?
I'd suggest that if it wasn't, it would have been taken up by private owners at a much earlier time.
What are the minerals that are of most interest to you in Schedule 4 land?
Initially, I think it is the good old staple gold. The Paparoa, it will be coking coal. And then alongside all of that are these minerals known as rare earth elements. I understand there are 11 of them. They all end in imbium, and I can get you the front part of those names at a later time. The interesting thing about them is that those earth elements currently have a value sort of in the vicinity of $300 to $500 per kilogram. But the one country that's got the most of them is slowly locking up its reserves for themselves, which is understandable. But the demand internationally for them is growing rapidly. So you'd expect that price curve to become very, very steep.
That figure of $194 billion that's mentioned is almost entirely dependent upon the work of Richard Barker, who's a mining consultant. In the interim, a few months before the consultation process closes, do you intend to do any independent valuations?
My understanding is that work is peer-reviewed by GNS.
He's also described it as a back-of-the-envelope estimate.
Yes, he thinks it's light. I think all you can take from those numbers, until you're actually getting something out of the ground and you're selling it, you just don't know.
Well, how can you strike a balance?
Because you can assess the size of the resource, and you can do that through the desktop analysis, the early geomagnetic surveys that were carried out throughout New Zealand. And, of course, the good old basic pick-and-shovel work that's been done over decades inside New Zealand as well. So accumulating all of that, that's an estimate.
So do you know what the value of the 7,058 hectares you're proposing to take out?
Something in the vicinity of $60 billion. But I strongly stress, that is totally back of the envelope. Until you have someone actually recovering that resource, you don't know. But what I do know is the industry in New Zealand is $2 billion a year contribution to GDP. It's about $1 billion exports. And if we are going to turn our export figures around, then getting relatively quickly to a point where that was doubled would be very, very considerable in its effect on our economy.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little puzzled how you can actually strike a balance when, from what you're saying, you won't know what the value of it is until you start doing it.
What we're saying, though, but even in opening these areas, what we're opening them to is a different type of prospecting. One of the things the paper stresses all the way through, and Minister Wilkinson said just before, is that normal RMA processes still prevail in all these cases. It's just the idea that you simply shut off completely, absolutely everything, is something that we've challenged with this document. And the public now get a chance to have their say in it.
New Zealanders don't like an ice cream stand on the beach. It's common sense. They're not going to like these proposals, are they? But yet, conservation's having to sort of press their head with them.
Oh, well, as we've said, there are already 82 mining licences on the conservation estate. There's already one in the middle of a national park, which is Paparoa. There is actually a win-win. If you look at Pike Mine, which is in Paparoa, they take part in the endangered blue duck program. They pay for a dock liaison officer. They pay for people to monitor and count the kiwi. And they're selling that conservation story. So in that case, it's a win-win. Rio Tinto's the same. They just gave the public 80 hectares of land as a sort of mountain to the sea track for the Western Petrel. So I think there are win-wins that actually can be made.
Your department or somebody's department has leaked these documents, so even within the department, people don't like what's going on. I mean, is it real consultation to find out what's happening, or no matter what people say, we're going to see these areas taken out of the dock estate?
No, it is real. It is real consultation. And I think if you look, talking about the dock estate, you have to remember it still goes from gravel pits at one end of the continuum up to sort of the iconic national parks like Fiordland at the other. So, there's a lot of conservation estate that is actually has lesser conservation values.
I think it's also interesting that when those documents were leaked, one of the major TV channels, I don't want to advertise for one, but they held one of those straw polls, the biggest poll they've ever had, and it was slightly better than 50-50 in favour of mining. And they were stressing throughout that, which I found interesting, national parks, which is not the intention here.
Anti-mining lobby has always been pretty strong in the Coromandel. Have you just made Sandra Gardner's seat marginal?
No, she's an excellent MP, and I think she has as good a feel for what people in Coromandel think as anybody. And she's comfortable with this.
Can you rule out open cast mining on any of this new land?
I think it's highly unlikely that the sort of big hole that you've got at Waihee would ever be dug in New Zealand again.
But can you rule it out?
Well, that's for a resource management process to rule out. And I would find it extraordinary if that were the case.
Are any of the companies likely to be mining for gold as a result of this around, it's quite close to Auckland?
There are licences up there held by New Zealand owned companies, so we don't know.
Will international companies be interested in this kind of, like, I mean, it's not huge amounts of money if you're coming from overseas and you've got a lot of, like, problems with having to deal with, I don't know, dealing with birds and the forests and stuff. Is it actually going to be a bit different than dealing with
them? I think the indications you've just had from Minister Wilkinson are that the mining companies are very, very aware of the responsibilities they have to do things that mitigate against the worst effects of their activity.
But on the other side, I mean, if we want international investment in New Zealand from these mining companies, are they going to want to come?
All we can do is say there's an opportunity and see what will happen.
So you haven't been approached as yet?
I'm aware that there are a number of companies who've expressed greater interest in New Zealand by taking out licence. That's public record.
Finally, why did you add Huarangi near Nelson onto the list? Is it anything to do with proposed agricultural research?
I'm sorry, why did we...
Hororoi Rangi off the coast of
Nelson. Yeah.
Why? You added it on the schedule 4, do you think?
Well, it wasn't me that added it. It was that's the official's consideration of things, but Purarangi is a likely spot for significant agricultural research in the future. Yeah.
That's the rationale.
No, I don't know what the rationale is. I presume there are some other ecological values there that they've pointed to.
You've changed the requirement for just the Minister of Conservation to both of you to effectively approve new land for conservation estate. Does that suggest a downgrading of the conservation value you put on that land?
No, I don't think so. I think what it suggests is that going through a process where there's ultimately one minister put in the gun for saying yes or no is pretty unreasonable. And what it does also say is that as well as the environmental considerations, the conservation considerations, there can be an economic consideration as well.
Is there ever a proposal to just make the energy minister or to leave the conservation minister out of it?
No, no. It's been a struggle to get the energy minister into it.
Yeah, that's my next question, actually. Are you comfortable with that,
Mr. Oh, yeah, I'm certainly comfortable with that. I think we have to look at both the economic opportunities and the conservation environmental responsibilities. At the end of the day, realistically, it would be a cabinet decision if we're doing anything sensitive. So I'm more than comfortable with the decision making.
So who's putting up the struggle?
Oh, no, I'm just saying, slinging off, I suppose, inappropriately, but you'll be used to that, that's right.
Okay.